Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending. With real-time notifications, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy, knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
And the Orioles have won the game!
They did it! They did it! They did it!
And they're going crazy! They're jumping on each other!
One of the most unbelievable finishes you will ever see.
And welcome to it. Thanks for being with us here on Orioles Magic, the podcast. Brett Hollander and Jeff Arnold. And Jeff, you know, there are a few utility players that really stand out in my mind. But if you had to paint a picture of what a utility player should be like in how he kind of plays the game, how truly he can play anywhere on the field, that'd be Jeff Rebele, who's coming up on our podcast today. Just a guy who hung around baseball for 12 years. And you know he brought a lot to the table if you have 12 years of big league service and only 20 home runs, but yet played a lot of games and played a lot of different positions.
And that's the whole thing about it, is if you're a utility player and you spend 12 years in the major leagues, that's unbelievably difficult to do. I mean, you said it in the podcast, I don't think he played in any more than 109 games in any single season, but Rebele was so good for the Orioles against Randy Johnson. I mean, his OPS against Johnson, I think, was around like 811 or something like that. Had a couple of different home runs, including one really big one in that ALDS game that we're talking about in this podcast.
Yeah, we get into a lot with Jeff Rebele, so enjoy every bit of it. His post-baseball life, his relationships to guys like Kirby Puckett. He played all around, so he got to meet a lot of baseball guys. And one thing I'll say about Jeff Rebele, as far as a guy you're interviewing, his recall is off the charts. So a really interesting conversation. But, of course, for Orioles fans, he played here for three seasons and hit one monster home run. And joining us right now on Orioles Magic, the podcast presented by Miller Lite, is someone who connected with some Orioles Magic back in 1997 when he hit a playoff home run off Randy Johnson, a part of an Orioles playoff series win over the loaded Seattle Mariners. Joining us right now, a guy who played in 12 big league seasons, three with the Baltimore Orioles, Jeff Rebele. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on. We appreciate it.
Oh, man, it's great to be here. Appreciate you guys having me on.
Well, let's talk about that October day in Baltimore. Orioles and Mariners, best of five series. It would end up being the clinching game for Baltimore, and you hit a home run of future Hall of Famer Randy Johnson.
Yeah, it was a good day. It was one of those afternoon games, and I was batting in the two hole behind Brady, and it was kind of like a shadowy day. So ended up got a 2-2 pitch that was off the plate, called a ball, got to 3-2, and got a fastball, and was able to, like I like to say, a blind squirrel finds an acorn, and put it in the left center. For me, obviously it was a great moment running around the bases, but I can't hit a home run unless a guy's throwing over 90. And of course, Randy can do that. So that's how, I think that's how that happened.
You had a lot of success against Randy Johnson in your career. What do you think were some keys to being able to get that many hits and a couple of home runs off of the big unit?
Yeah. I played against him a lot in the minor leagues as well. So I'd seen him probably 50 plus times in the minor leagues. And then, cause you played a lot of games against the same teams. And then throughout my career, I think in Minnesota, I got my first start at first base, learned first base in an hour and a half before the game started, and gave Kent Herbeck a day off. And I had pretty good success against Randy. And so from then on, I just kept kind of like having days, and for whatever reason, I don't know if it's my approach or what, but every time we played him, whatever team I was on, we've always done well. So I guess I feel like you got to get him early. Once good pitchers get locked in, it's kind of over. And it was kind of like that in that series, you know, and Mike Mussina was unbelievable. They couldn't get to him, and he just pitched lights out. And we were able to get to Randy a little bit early and make him uncomfortable, and I think we just hung on enough.
It's it's amazing when you look at Johnson's line. I mean, he goes the distance in the game in a loss. He strikes out 13 Orioles, but you do just enough. You hit one, Geronimo Baroa hit one. And you mentioned Mike, who, you know, going in on paper around Baltimore, we understood what Mike was about. But I think on the national stage, no one would put those two necessarily in the same class of pitching.
Yeah, I mean, Mussina was unbelievable during that time. That was the best I've seen him throw. Like, he was just nails. And even into the Cleveland series, he was unbelievable. The one thing about Randy is, and I kind of pass this information on to guys as I play with him, like, he's going to strike you out. Like, he's going to get at least one guy. He's going to get everybody once and some guys twice and maybe some guys three times. So you just got to get that one hit. You got to really, like, make him work. And I think that was the approach we all kind of had. And, you know, I think Mussina outpitched, you know, Randy Johnson, which is hard to do, right? Because he's one of the best in the games ever. And, you know, it was just a great series for us. I was glad to be a part of it. Didn't do a whole lot in the first game. I laid down a sack bunt with two strikes, and that's kind of an interesting story. But then I think Eric Davis drove in the guys to put us ahead. And we kind of went on to win those games pretty easily, 9-3, I think. And then they came back at our place and won. And then we were able to do it in game four, which was the game that I hit the one in the first inning. And like you said, you talked about all these guys, but there was a lot of guys that had great series. And I know I can think of Baroa had an unbelievable series. Cal played great. Bordick played great. And of course, Mussina was, you know, Mike Mussina.
Davey Johnson elected to start a couple of different right-handed hitting lineups against Randy Johnson. It ended up working out, but you also sat through your best left-handed batters. You didn't have Roberto Alomar. You didn't have Rafael Palmeiro. BJ Surhoff didn't play either. Was there any surprise at all that you would maybe have sat those guys before, you know, the results ended up working out the way that they did?
Yeah, there were some question marks to that. I think the media plays more into that. During the season, like we said, we played the right-hand lineup and beat him, I think, every time. So, you know, in hindsight, you look at it. I look back on it, and I know, you know, when you're playing to the media, Davey Johnson, you know, it took some guts for him to put that lineup out there. Clearly, you're sitting Alomar and playing me. That there's, you're putting your, you know, your butt on the line there. And, you know, I think we did enough, and you know, you don't want to mess with success, but there's going to be a lot of talk about that, right, when you have such a disparity between players. You know, you got a utility guy, and you got a guy who's, you know, surefire Hall of Famer, right? So at that time, I think Robbie had a little shoulder issue, and they kind of said something about that, but he could hit pretty good. I think I just faced Randy Johnson pretty well. But I do know this. There's a spot in the game, every game, but in the first game, I think it was in Seattle, and I had just come up to hit again, and I think I made an out or something, and we were up a pretty good amount, whatever it was. And Davey comes to me at the end of the dugout, and he's like, I got to take you out. And I look at him, I'm like, I totally get it. Like, if I make an error and cost us three runs or something, and he's got a Hall of Fame, you know, gold glove infielder, that's perennial gold glover at second base, and he didn't take him out, like, his, you know, he's really in trouble. So we made that move, and I totally get that. But I talked to him later on. I appreciate him putting me in there because it did take guts, and of course, he appreciates me doing well for him and making him look good.
Jeff, that Orioles team wins 98 games. They go wire to wire, best regular season record in baseball. But I think the consensus in baseball, and certainly Baltimore fans felt this way, that the Orioles were somehow underdogs in this series to the Seattle Mariners. I think if you count it out, there's six or seven Hall of Famers between the two teams in this series, and that's excluding Alex Rodriguez right now. It was a heavyweight fight, but, I mean, I know it happened in the LCS, obviously, but it's certainly a validation of how good that team was in 1997.
Yeah, I think the concept was you didn't want to face Seattle because you're going to get Randy Johnson twice, right? So that was the big thing, and if you can get by Randy, then you know you're in good shape. So, you know, us – you know, I think we have more Hall of Famers than they do right now. We had a great team. You know, I look at teams, I look back on that. We could have won a lot more games. We went through a stretch later on where later in the year we lost some games and we were winning like a 700 win percentage clip. And we lost a few games in a row and the Yankees started closing a little bit. And we're like, okay, the guys just turned it back on, right? And that was how good we were. We had guys on the bench. You know, Harold Baines is on the bench for, you know, crying out loud. That's that tells you how good that team was and the players we had. So, yeah, that was big. It was just a great experience for me. I think the, you know, just being on a great winning team like that and knowing how good we were, it was fun to be a part of that in Baltimore.
How much of a role did Davey Johnson have in that team, making it as successful as it was?
I think when you're in it at the time, you're not really sure. I think the true sign for him was when he left. And, you know, there was a lot of times I didn't think he was making decisions. He kind of let the guys play. About the seventh inning, you'd look down at the end of the dugout, and, you know, you weren't sure what he was doing the first six innings, you know. But you look down there, all of a sudden, you know, late in the game in the American League, you know, that's when things start clicking. You watch down there. He knew what was going on. He made all the right moves on the pitching side. And, you know, I know Ray Miller was a pitching coach at the time, but Davey made a lot of those calls, man. And it really – it showed up. And he got his guys ready to go, and he let us play, and we were talented as heck. So I give him a lot of credit. I really do. I think he was. I think he was a very good manager. He was very good with a lot of talent, and we had that. And I think it was a good time for the Orioles to have him in '97.
Really good rotation that year with Mussina, Key, Erickson, and Kamenicki had a good year, but a great bullpen. I mean, you can make a case it's one of the best bullpens in baseball history. Not only was it full of guys who had great seasons from Rhodes and Orozco and Alan Mills and Armando Benitez, but Randy Myers,
yes.
He goes 45 of 46, I think.
Yeah, it was something ridiculous, man. I mean, it's, you know, Randy, I mean, he just has I don't know what he has. He has the disappearing fastball. Like, he throws a fastball up there, they just can't see it. I don't know what happens, but, you know, and he just was coming at you, and here it is, and just was awesome that year. And you're right, the bullpen was unbelievable. I mean, Arthur Rhodes comes in the middle of games and vultured in about seven or eight wins just in middle relief. Like, you know, because we knew we were going to put up points. I mean, how could you not put up points with that lineup? And so Arthur would keep us around. He maybe a right-hander would have a tough day and had a lefty lineup, and he would go in there and mow them down for three or four innings. And then, you know, when the game got tough, we got ahead. Man, when they had that back end of the bullpen was unbelievable. So you can see, I mean, you just have to go back and look at it. You don't realize it at the time. We knew we were good, but you look back and, those, you know, we got Hall of Fame. I mean, we got all-star players that are on the bench. You know, Hall of Famers sitting the bench. You know, it was pretty impressive.
You added a great defender in Mike Bordick, who would play at shortstop, and then Cal shifted over to third base. How did Cal handle that transition, and what was it like playing with him?
Oh, it was awesome, man. I mean, that was – Two of my favorite players to play with. I mean, just, you know, Mike Bordick can catch a ground ball and throw it to first base, man. I mean, that is just – that's something. You hit it to him, and it's an out, right? And Cal was learning third. But, you know, he's always been a great defender, and he's long and lanky. And he's going to put every part of his mental game into that and learning how to do that and be the best at it. I noticed that, you know, he'd been playing a while, right? And clearly a lot of games in a row. And, you know, he was playing third base in spring training. He would take a lot of grounders. He was working on his angles and his throws. And about halfway through the year, I'd go over there because, you know, in batting practice, you would go up to him. And I'd start with Cal, see if he wanted any throws at second. And Robbie would take some grounders, or he would go in and hit. And then Bordy was the last one to go in and hit. And then the utility guy would bat in the group four. So I would catch all the guys first, make sure they were good to go, because that's what you do as a utility guy. And Cal, halfway through the year, stopped. I'm like, hey, you want some at third? And he's like, no, I'm good. So I knew he was feeling comfortable about playing third base at that time. And he's saving his arm, you know, because it's a long season. And he was putting a lot of work from spring training on to be the best at third base. And he really did a nice job of that, you know. And obviously he's, you know, who he is, and he thinks about every position and how he's going to, you know, how he's going to decide cutoffs differently at third. He's going to try everything that's never been done before. Like, that's his mindset, is I'm going to figure out ways to make myself as better than everybody else. And I'm going to analyze every situation and try and figure out how to do it best. And that's what he did.
What was it like to see Roberto Alomar play second base on a daily basis as a infielder?
It was awesome. And again, taking ground balls, if you didn't get there before early to watch batting practice, like you missed it, because that's when he got a lot of ground balls, right? So he would go over there, and after Cal would throw his, I would get Robbie, and I would just stand it short at the base, and he would do these back flips from almost first base, backhand flips, and he would take his glove and swat it at me. It would come, ground ball come flying at me, he'd just take his glove and swat it right here on the stick every time. And I'm like, this is unbelievable. And then his last one would always be, I think Sammy Peraza would roll, hit one in the hole, like almost by first base, slow, and he'd run over and backhand behind him and swat it back to me. And sometimes it would go all the way to me, and I'd catch it. I mean, that's just – I mean, I know those are fancy things, but he was that talented. He'd go between his legs, and he would flip, and then he would just do his normal flip. So, you know, he was just that talented, quick. What I was most impressed with is I'll say this, you know, to the day I die, people ask me, like, who is the most – who's the best player you ever played with? And honestly, I think talent-wise, it was Robbie Alomar. When Robbie Alomar wanted to play, he was a five-tool guy, and he would turn it on. I mean, he – I saw a game where Clemens threw at him in Toronto, kind of woke him up a little bit, and it was a battle, and they were screaming at each other. And then he, after about five, six more pitches, rifled one off the right center field wall, and he was standing on third. I thought he was going to go for four. Like, he was flying. And so that's the kind of talent level we were dealing with, you know, and that's, you know, again, it's just another cog in why we did so well. He was a great player.
That 97 Orioles infield was the best defensive infield that you were a part of in your big league career?
Yeah, you have to say that. I mean, I think, you know, I know Palmeiro got a gold glove or whatever, and he dropped his 40 bombs a year, 140 RBIs. And it the gold glove thing can kind of be an offensive position thing at times. So if you don't hit, you may not get it. So I think Bordy got, you know, I know he was dealing with Vizquel a little bit too, but until Bordy hit, he didn't get his gold gloves, right? And the dude ran off like, what, he would go a whole season or something plus and not making an error? And he didn't make one again until he became a utility guy in Toronto. I give him crap about that. He was playing third and made an error. So I say, he's like, it's hard. I'm like, well, it's hard playing every day too. Trust me. You know, that the aches and pains of that. So, yeah, I mean, and Cal playing third, he was so solid. And, you know, just the extra guys we had, you know, even the backup guys like myself and, you know, Aaron Ledesma, whoever came up was, you know, it was a serious thing. We played defense, and trust me, guys like Randy Myers, I can remember playing Atlanta. It was a ground ball up the middle, and I'm playing second, and it's like we're up by one, and there's a guy on second or third, and I caught the backhand pretty far up the middle and made the play, flipped it over there. And after the game, he's like, you better make that play. And I'm thinking, wow, that's kind of crazy. But, you know, that's just the way Randy was. But they expected you to perform, right? I mean, you go out, this is a professional game. And we were, you know, number one in our division and probably the best, like you said, the best record in baseball. And we went out there and did it every day on defense, pitching.
Jeff, I love your baseball reference page. 12 seasons, no more than 109 games in any one of them, no more than 240 at-bats. And let me read off this. 261 games at second, 342 games at short, 240 games at third, 40 at first base, 24 in the outfield, and one catching.
One catching.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
Yeah. It was somebody mentioned it to me the other day. They're like, well, you didn't pitch. And I'm like, well, if I don't know, it was such a big deal. You know, they talk about these guys playing all the positions. I'm like, I could have done that. The catcher's the hard one. Pitching was – I did get – interesting story. I did pitch in double A in a blowout game, and I faced David Howard, who was in the big leagues, Tommy Dunbar, who played a long time in the minor leagues in Japan, and then I got Jeff Conine out. So I give him crap when I play with Niner the next year or the next 2 years. And, yeah, so I could have pitched. I actually, you know, I went sinker and a changeup any time. So I figured throwing 85 wouldn't be good. I'd rather throw 82 with a little sink. And that worked out because I think 85 is pretty much batting practice speed. So that wouldn't have been good.
Do you remember the game that you caught at all?
I do. It wasn't good. Yeah. We our starting catcher, Matt Walbeck, was hurt, and the backup started. They pinch hit for the backup. I was the emergency catcher. And I would catch once every spring, you know, just to get some innings in. And I caught a lot of bullpens. And Matt Walbeck was hurt, and he wanted to go back in the game because he knew we were going to have to pinch hit. So I pinch hit for the catcher. We didn't tie it up. We're down one. I think it turned into a, like a I think they scored four or five. It wasn't good. They stole on me. I almost threw him out, but I bounced at the second. I ran up the line. It was just a – it was a great experience, but not a fun experience while you're going through it, because everything we threw up there, I'm like, I'm obviously not very good at calling pitches because they were getting – rocketed everywhere. And and then when it bounced in the dirt, I wasn't a block guy, I was a shortstop, right? So I just pick everything with my hands. And I think finally somebody bounced one in front of the plate, bounced over my head, so I got let one get by me. But other than that, it was, you know, it's pretty cool to say I caught an inning in the big leagues, and it was actually a meaningful inning. It wasn't like we're up by 20 or down by 20. It was a tight game, so it didn't work out, but it was fun.
Jeff, the daily preparation for all the positions you could play. I mean, I think, you know, maybe the average fan says second, short, third, what's the difference? But for you on a day-to-day basis, to keep yourself in the big leagues, take us through that.
Yeah, I mean, when I came up, I actually got one chance to start in Minnesota. I had gotten moved around. I was a shortstop through the minor leagues. And then they had some higher picks than me that came in or trade. Andy McPhail had made a trade, and so they moved me around. The kid didn't like playing third because it was too close. So I ended up having to play third, second, move me around. And that ended up obviously being my tool, because I was going to play defense. And, you know, when you're a solid defender, you can pretty much play anywhere as a defender. If you can play short, you can play all the other ones. And so I was able to do that. And then that kind of kept me around in the organization for a longer time. I was kind of a suspect. You know, there's prospects and then there's suspects. I became a suspect and just kind of hung around, became a utility guy behind starters in double A again for like my fourth year. But I was able to get a break. Scott Lais made the team with Mike Pagliarulo at third. They ended up winning a World Series the following year. Was able to make the triple A team. And then in 92, I got called up. And I did have a chance to start, but I was going through a terrible swing at the time. Greg Gagne got hurt. And so I didn't get, I think I had probably 25 at bats. He played me for like a week, and it just wasn't going well for me offensively. Defensively, I was fine. And they kind of just decided, well, you're more valuable anyways as a utility guy. And I was probably okay with that because I was happy to be in the big leagues. And so I did that for the next few years. And then in 2003, after I left Baltimore and did all that, 2003 – with Pittsburgh, I got released by the Orioles in spring training. He took a Rule 5 guy, and I actually thought I'd made the team. Hargrove told me I made the team, then he had to come back and tell me I didn't make the team. Ended up in Pittsburgh, AAA, getting ready again after sitting home for almost retiring. And what happened there? So I got called up. Pukki Rees blew out his thumb and gave me an opportunity, got called up. And a week later, I was starting every day at 39 years old for a couple of months. And I know, hit 310 for about a month or so, 315, batting in the two hole. And it was fun, but it killed my body. I was so done, you know. And I was already doing the financial thing, which I do now, while I was playing. So the next year when I went back to spring training, I'm like, unless I got a guaranteed contract, my body was shot. So I kind of just shut it down.
Did you have a favorite position at all? If someone would have given you an opportunity and said, well, Jeff, you can put yourself in at any spot in the lineup card today, what would you have decided?
Yeah, as a utility guy, you're used to, you know, playing different positions. If you haven't played somewhere in a while, like in certain organizations, I had not played, like in LA, I didn't play third base because they had Adrian Beltre there. And I'm like, I hadn't been there in a month and a half or whatever. And they're like, you want to go play third, you know, or would you rather play short? I'm like, well, I hadn't played third in a while. And I felt like I needed to keep my skills up, but I went over there and of course I was terrible. You know, just, it's just a different angle. So for a utility guy, whatever you've been playing the most recently is what you want to play. You know, if you've been playing second base and they move you to short and you hadn't been there a while, it's a little nerve wracking. Like you feel like you hadn't been there in years. So that's really my thing as a utility guy. I never really enjoyed the outfield much. I know Davey stuck me out there for a start and right versus Carlos Perez. And, you know, I didn't really screw anything up, but I just felt like, man, I just was really out of sorts there. I was a fish out of water. But that's a tough position. It's a lot tougher than people realize. So it's first base. Like you go over there. Now, if you've been there a while, I kind of get used to it. I mean, your first start over there, you hadn't been over there in a while, man, it's there's a lot going on in your brain of what to do in certain situations. When to go get a ball. You know, you go too far, you got Robbie Alomar sitting over there, can cover a lot of ground. So you got to make decisions quickly, and it's different throws and everything. But that's kind of my thing as a utility guy. Whatever you've been playing the most recently is probably where you're most comfortable.
Going back, Jeff, to your time in Baltimore, obviously the team was great in 97. Things did not work out the way a lot of people hoped for in 98 and 99. But just the atmosphere at the ballpark, the sellout crowds, the expecting to win atmosphere and to play alongside the Cals of the world and so many other really, you know, really good to great players. What was that experience like looking back at your career?
It was great. I mean, obviously we expected to win. I almost felt like we had as good of a team, if not maybe better in 98. I'm just trying to remember the differences, but, you know, just didn't work out. You know, sometimes things just don't flow the way they, you know, you expect them to. And, you know, it's a long season and you lose a couple games here or there. And there's some things going on in the background that nobody knows about that usually happen. You know, there's things that are happening there. I don't disagree with, Ray Miller coming in or whatever. He was, you know, a great pitching coach. I think the communication sometimes got a little lost with some of the veteran guys. But, you know, that we just didn't get it done when we needed to get it done. And we had the talent. And for whatever reason, it just didn't work out. And in 99, it dropped off more, you know, and we still had a pretty good team. So, and at that point, there was a lot of transactions happening. And I think Kevin Malone got fired or what have you. And then there's this changeover and then it's rebuild, right? And at that point, you know, people are looking for the exits. I can remember Richie Amarill and myself were sitting here late in the year going, we got to get out of here or we're going to be gone. Like, we're not going to play. And I ended up getting traded for a double-A infielder that they released a week later, which got me to Kansas City and kept my career going. And I actually did well over there. Richie, I think, ended up – didn't get traded, hung around, and was released early in the next season. And that's kind of how you know as a veteran guy. You kind of see those things coming when they're rebuilding like that. And as a guy like myself or anybody who's on the bench – you're a kind of a luxury item. You need to be on really good teams or they don't really need you. They want the young guys to come up and try and learn. And, you know, they don't want to pay you for whatever that reason is. And so you got to try and find places. And in Kansas City, they had a younger team and they needed a veteran guy who could kind of work with guys and young guys. And it was a joy going over there. And then I was able to move on from there to LA. And then for 2 years, had a chance to start there a little bit late in the year. We almost got in the playoffs and then ended up in Pittsburgh in 2003.
When you go back to that 97 ALCS, do you think maybe some of the problems in that series came from a little bit of a letdown that it wasn't the Yankees? Because after what happened the previous year, when they fell to New York and you have the Jeffrey Mayer incident that happens, was there maybe any talk that had something to maybe do with what happened after you guys had beaten the Mariners?
No, not really. I don't think we really feared anybody. I think what happened was, there's some underlying things that go on there, but we just didn't play as well as we had been playing. We went through a little stretch where, you know, some of our, I think Raffy struggled a little bit getting guys in. They had this lefty coming in on him every time. And for whatever reason, he struggled with him. And there was a lot of big situations where that guy pitched really well. And that was just, you know, one of those guys that you face that seemed to always be right there at the wrong time for us. You know, so that kind of struggled. But I think there was, if you recall in that series, there's a lot of weird plays that went on and things that cost us games, like the foul tip, squeeze play, you know, that we think is, you know, that ended the game right there. And, you know, we win that game, we probably go on to win. There was extra inning stuff going on. There was just some weird things that happened in that series that kind of put us back. One of the big things was they had Armando Benitez's pitches, so he struggled, right? So when you go in there, and I've talked to Marquise Grissom about this as well because I play with him in L.A., and I still do things with Marquise once in a while, but he was deathly ill. Marquise was like on his – they weren't sure he was going to play. He was taking IVs. He gets up there. We blow a couple fastballs by him. We're up two in the ninth. I guess it's been top of the ninth, and Marquise comes up and after throwing a couple fastballs by him, hits a slider or a split for a three-run homer and could not catch up to the high heater. So for whatever reason, they knew the fastball was coming and they couldn't hit it. But when they knew a breaking ball was coming, they could sit on it a little better and maybe make contact. And he ended up hitting a three-run homer. And that turned that whole series, because that's game two. We go into Cleveland up 2-0 versus now it's 1-1. We got to win in Cleveland a couple times, right? So, and then with the crazy things that happened in Cleveland, with all the crazy games, extra innings, and the things going on, you know, we needed to win game six, which was difficult. And Mussina pitched his butt off, and we just couldn't get the runs in to drive him in. And so I think we were the better team. And I would have liked that Marlins matchup, because we played them earlier in the year, and it was in Florida, and it was big boy baseball. You could tell, you know, everybody thought it was us in Atlanta. We played Atlanta when we kind of really walked through Atlanta during the season. But man, Florida had a good team, so that would have been interesting. And clearly, Cleveland was playing well, and they made it close.
Yeah, and the final pitch of the series was about 10 feet off the plate inside to Roberto Alomar, and it was called a strike. That's the way it ended, unfortunately.
There's a lot of that going on, and you know, you can't blame it on umpires with everything going on.
Of course.
But there was some crazy stuff that happened. It just, you know, it was a great experience for me. I mean, it was nerve-wracking as heck. There was some things going on in the field. We weren't sure where we were going with the ball, and you know, I've got Hall of Fame guys next to me. What are you going to do? I don't know. What are you going to do? And Davey came out to the mound, and it was extra innings, and he's like, hey, I don't care, you know, turn the double play, but don't let them score. And they had three fast guys on the field. Like, we can't do that. There's no way. They're too fast. So we kind of were deciding what to do. And then right before the last pitch is thrown, Cal goes, I'm going home. So Robbie looks at me and he goes, I'm going home. I'm like, okay, we're going home. So we played in, and the next ball is a rocket to third. Cal dives and gets it from his knees, kind of looks over at third and flips it to first from his knees, I think, and gets the out. Ended up getting out of the inning. But after that play, he looks at me and he goes, did we have the double play? Did we have him at second? I'm like, no, there's nobody there. We just decided that 10 seconds ago. So it's just kind of the craziness that goes on in a world, you know, or a playoff game. And those plays are decided, and, you know, we made some of them, and Cleveland just made a few more of them, got a few more breaks, in my opinion.
Jeff, when you went to junior college, you had an opportunity to play with Kirby Puckett. What do you remember about him as a player? Because you play with a number of Hall of Famers with the Orioles, and Puckett obviously reached the Hall of Fame as well. And to me, maybe somebody that was forgot about a little bit from some of those great players in the 90s.
Yeah, Puck was awesome, man. He was actually a friend of mine. We went to Triton Junior College together. That's my jersey in the background. We're both in the Hall of Fame there with Lance Johnson and the Bob Simmons, the coach there. And there's been a lot of great players come out of there. So we have a little bond beforehand. But going to Minnesota, he kind of took me under his wing a little bit, took care of me. But watching him play, he was just so much fun to watch, man. That guy, being small in stature, just hit missiles. Like, I mean, rockets everywhere. And he could run. Nobody really realized that. He ran a 6'2", 60 on the track at Triton before he got drafted, which is, you know, world-class speed. And he could, you know, so you hit a ground ball and he's running down the line. You had to hurry like an Ichiro almost. Like, he was getting it, and he smoked the ball. So, great player, had a cannon for an arm, just controlled the clubhouse. But the beauty of Puck was that not many people know is that was one of the funniest dudes that I ever played with. Like, that every day he had me between him and Randy Bush, who's now assistant GM in Chicago with the Cubs. He was dry. Bushy was dry, but Puck would make you laugh so hard. And Herbeck was funny as well. And those three going all day long, man, I was in tears. I mean, literally, I would laugh so hard. I would cry every day. And, you know, baseball is stressful and what have you, but these guys made it fun, man. And I mean, everybody you talk to that played with Puck, they know. Like, this guy was just fun to be around and just a great competitor. And quite frankly, he saved my career. My second year in, I hadn't been known as a hitter, obviously, I never was. But I could swing it a little bit. And I used an H238 of 34-31, which is kind of like, I think Griffey used it. I think Bonds might use it too. But it's a bigger barrel, thinner handle. And I would swing that around and I do my thing. And I'm playing, and before a game, were taking batting practice in I guess it was Cleveland. And before the game, Puck must have known something, because I was hitting like 170 or something. I don't know what I was hitting. And it wasn't going well. They had taken me and started using his bats, which were 35, 35, 36, 35. And they had me choking up halfway on the barrel, on the bat, and trying to shoot everything in right field. And for a week, 10 days, I'm doing this, and it's terrible. Like, I'm flying out there, jamming me. This is the worst experience of my life. And he finally comes up to me, and he knew something was going on. He comes up in batting practice, didn't really notice what was going on. He goes, "Hey, Reb," he goes, "you know, you're struggling, whatever." He goes, "You know, sometimes you got to do what got you here. You're a good player. You got here because you're a good player doing what you do. He goes, sometimes you just got to do what you got to do and just go back to what makes you good, right? And, you know, there's going to be a lot of people talking about a lot of things you got to do. Just be you." I'm like, okay. So during that game, I go up and I make another out. And Tom Kelly, using some frank terms, says, "You better start getting some bleepity bleep hits. You know, I don't care what bat you use, but you can go use the thin bat or you can use the big bat, but whatever you're doing ain't working. And you're embarrassing your family and your friends." He goes, "Just start getting some hits." So that's the kind of stuff you deal with in the big leagues, right? So I take Puck's advice, you know, and Terry Crowley was our hitting coach at the time too. So I had to look Crow in the eye, who was a great hitting coach, man. Crow was the best. He really was. But they were trying to work on this new approach. And I look at Crow, and I went back and got one of Scotty Leyes's T141s, which is a thin bat. I didn't even have mine on the road. And from then on, got 12 more or 11 more years in the big league. So I owe Puck a lot for that. I actually have the last glove he ever played with. And he gave it to me when his eye went bad. And he goes, "You keep it. You know, you're going to need it more than I am right now." And so I still have that. But that guy was a special person, man. In the game, missed a lot because he had a lot left to play.
Do you have your home run off Randy Johnson in the ALDS?
I have the bat, and I ended up using it again. I broke it somewhere in the playoffs. I think it was in Cleveland. So I still have it. It's got a crack in it somewhere. I don't I have some things I display, but none of it's my own stuff. But yeah, I still have that. I got a lot of stuff from just, you know, back in the day. Nobody really knows that I have it, but I got some pretty cool stuff. Puck, actually, when he was done, he gave me one of his the metal plating that they put for newspapers back in the day. They used to have the plates. He gave me one of those plates. And I can't remember what it was for. It must have been for retirement or something. Well, it must have been the Hall of Fame, maybe. I don't know what it was. But I have that. So I have some really cool stuff. But, yeah, man, it's interesting when you play this game long enough, you run across a bunch of guys, you see some amazing things, you meet amazing people. And he was one of those guys. And, of course, the Orioles in 97, man, has just a crazy group of guys, man. It was a lot of fun and a lot of good players to play together.
Last one, Jeff, tell us what you're doing right now and your connection to baseball still.
Yeah. So right now I'm a financial advisor. I have a lot of former players and current players and minor league guys as clients. Brian Bass in Baltimore is in our Baltimore office, is also works with me, and we have affiliations with other groups. We have a broker dealer we deal with. So we're doing that. We travel around and go see guys. Still get to stay in the game that way, go to spring training and do things. Players Association, Major League Baseball Players Association, I've been working with them for a long time. I do their rookie career development program. That's a joint venture with them and MLB. Brings in the top prospects for 4 days to talk about life in the big leagues. So I'm one of the 10 former players they bring back to have discussions with those guys. And it talks about how to deal with the media, all kinds of things. But as a former player, we can help them and mentor them. So I still have a lot of contacts with guys like that. Trey Mancini was one of my guys, a good dude, and I wish the best for Trey. Adam Jones. I had a lot of guys in my small group. And then there's guys that are in the big group. But we usually get about 10 guys in a group, and that's pretty cool. I work with youth baseball. I'm on the youth advisory board for Major League Baseball Players Association. And we're trying to make youth baseball a little bit better again. It's kind of getting out of hand. So a lot of good things there. And other than that, I run an organization, a nonprofit for baseball here locally in Dayton, Ohio, where I'm from. And just getting kids out playing and trying to grow the great game of baseball. And then doing my thing here. And then, like I said, Brian has a, as an office in Baltimore, and we're busy with that, man. That's what we do all the time.
That all sounds awesome. Sounds like you've had a very fulfilling post-baseball career after 12 big league seasons, three with the Orioles, 20 regular season home runs, but one very special one in the postseason off Randy Johnson that helped the Orioles seal the deal against a powerful Mariners ball club. Jeff, that was awesome. Thank you so much for going back down memory lane with us.
Well, thanks for the great questions, and best to you guys. And hopefully we'll be back playing soon. And go O's, man. We'd love to see them have a great year.
Well, that's Rebs, or Rebby as they called him, Jeff Rebelay. Again, 12 big league seasons, three with the Orioles, the monster blast of Randy Johnson in the clinching ALDS game of 1997 at Camden Yards. But really a guy, you know, Jeff, we've been around this long enough to know, podcast and beyond, the guys you know you can talk for like another 3 hours with, and Jeff Rebelay is one of those guys. I mean, we could have gone down the rabbit hole of Tom Kelly or any coach or teammate he ever had and just had a lot of great baseball stories.
How about that story about what Tom Kelly told him walking down into the dugout and the advice that he got from his buddy Kirby Puckett, which eventually helped Rebelay get things back on track and ultimately put together a 12-year major league career.
You're embarrassing your family and your friends.
Hey, you know what? Tom Kelly was a great manager.
Great manager. Two rings, right?
Fantastic with the Minnesota Twins. And then he played for some great managers when you think about it. Tom Kelly, Davey Johnson. I mean, he played for some really good ones and had an extended career with, like we said, going that long as a utility player. You can't point to a whole lot of utility men that spent 12 years in the major leagues. But Rebelay managed to do it. And his recall and his storytelling, I really enjoyed the part about Roberto Alomar where he talked about that Alomar might have been the best player that he ever played with. And it's been interesting, maybe on this podcast, we've had some of these conversations with players both during the podcast and maybe off air as well about how you're getting a lot of people that talk about in those teams in the 90s, maybe the best player that was there, five tools, would have been Roberto Alomar for what he provided in his short time with the Orioles.
No, I would agree that Alomar, you know, was in the top three or four most talented players I ever saw play, especially up close. But beyond that, the work ethic of Alomar, Cal, and Bordick, I think is really interesting because, you know, obviously there's a huge level of skill to get to the big leagues. And I think we often kind of take that for granted. But, you know, Ripken moving from short to third late in his career, the flips we saw Roberto Alomar make, it felt like he was just purely improvising in those moments, but he clearly spent, you know, hours a week on everything you saw on game day. And then what he said about our colleague, Mike Bordick, no truer words probably ever spoken about Mike Bordick. If it was a ground ball to Bordick, it was an out. And that's the reality of it. So what an infield, what a ball team, and so much fun reminiscing with Rebelay.
And don't forget Rafael Palmeiro as far as defensive players go, too. I mean, he had so many good years offensively with the Orioles, but you don't maybe consider the fact that he was a Gold Glove caliber first baseman, too. And it was funny because when I was – I think it was my second to last year in the Carolina League before coming up there, and you talk about Roberto Alomar doing all the glove flips and things like that. Omar Vizquel, he was managing the Winston-Salem Dash, and – he would get out on the field during batting practice, and he would do a lot of those same things, even the fact that I think Vizquel is probably right around 50, something like that, probably a little older than 50. He can still do all those glove flips and those kinds of things. And, you know, I would imagine that somebody like Roberto Alomar, you could put him out on the infield, have him take some ground balls. I'm sure he could still do some of those tricks too.
All right, a lot of fun today speaking with Jeff Rebelay and Jeff Arnold. That was fun.
It was a blast. I think that was one of our better episodes with Jeff Rebelay. And
wow.
You're right. We could have gone on with him for probably another hour or so and get some more of those great stories because he's got a lot of them.
All right. Well, that does it for us today. Be safe and well, everyone. Until next time, this has been Orioles Magic, the podcast presented by Miller Lite.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.